Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is August the 14th, 2019. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can also leave us a message at pcradioshow.org with your questions or comments. AVTest is an independent IT security institute that spent May and June continuously evaluating 20 home user security products, using their default settings to see which offered the best protection. Only 4 of those products achieve a top score. And, believe it or not, one of them was Microsoft Windows Defender. Microsoft and best antivirus aren't usually written in the same sentence, but they're going to have to be in the following latest antivirus test results. The other 3 that scored at the top were F-Secure Safe 17, Kaspersky Internet Security 19.0, and Norton Security 22.17. The big difference, however, between these and Windows Defender is the fact that Microsoft includes Windows Defender for free with Windows 10, whereas the others require a paid subscription to continue being fully functional. Of the other products evaluated, WebRoot Secure Anywhere 9.0 came in last. Those that just missed out on top scores while still earning an AVTest Top Product Award included Avast Free Antivirus 19.5, AVG Internal Security 19.5, Bitdefender Internet Security 23.0, Trend Micro Internet Security 15.0, and Viper Advanced Security 11.0. There's clearly a lot of choice on antivirus market today, and most of the options offer good protection. But Microsoft is now setting a very high bar. It beats most of the competition and is completely free for Windows 10 users. Everyone else really needs to up their game and their value proposition if they want to keep selling security software to Windows users. Microsoft officials warn that hackers working for the Russian government have been using printers, video decoders, and other so-called Internet of Things devices as a beachhead to penetrate targeted computer networks. Microsoft catches Russian state workers using these devices to breach networks. The Microsoft Threat Intelligence Center reported these devices became points of ingress from which the actor established a presence on the network and continued working for further access. Once the actor had successfully established access to the network, a simple network can scan to look for other insecure devices to allow them to discover and move across the network in search of higher privilege accounts that would grant access to higher value data. After gaining access to each of the Internet of Things devices, the actor can sniff network traffic on local subnets. They were also seen enumerating administrative groups to attempt further exploitation. As the actor moved from one device to the other, they would drop a simple shell script to establish a persistence on the network, which allowed extended access to continued hunting. Microsoft researchers discovered the attacks in April when a voice-over IP phone, an office printer, and a video decoder in multiple customer locations were communicating with servers belonging to Strontium. Strontium is a Russian government hacking group better known as Fancy Bear. In 2 cases, the passwords for the devices were the easily guessable default ones that they ship with. In the 3rd instance, the device was running an old firmware version with a known vulnerability. While Microsoft officials concluded that Strontium was behind the attacks, they said they weren't able to determine what the group's ultimate objectives were. Last year, the FBI concluded the hacking group, Strontium, was behind the infection of more than 500,000 consumer-grade routers in 54 countries, dubbed VPN Filter. The malware was a Swiss Army hacking knife of sorts. Advanced capabilities included the ability to monitor, log, or modify traffic passing between network endpoints and websites or industrial control systems. The FBI, with assistance from Cisco Security Group, ultimately neutralized VPN Filter. Fancy Bear was one of two Russian-sponsored groups that hacked the Democratic National Committee ahead of the 2016 presidential election. Strontium has also been linked to intrusions into the World Anti-Doping Agency in 2016. The German Bundestag and France's TV5 Mondo TV station, among many others. Last month, Microsoft said it had notified almost 10,000 customers in the past year that they were being targeted by nation-sponsored hackers. Strontium was one of the hacker groups that Microsoft named. Microsoft has notified the makers of the targeted devices so they can explore the possibility of adding new protections. The report also provided IP addresses and script organizations that can be used to detect if they have also been targeted or infected. Beyond that, the report reminded people that despite Strontium's above-average hacking abilities, an IoT device is often all it needs to gain access to a targeted network. The report noted that while much of the industry focuses on the threats of hardware implants, we can see in this example that adversaries are happy to exploit simpler and configurations and security issues to achieve their objectives. These simple attacks taking advantage of weak device management are likely to expand as more IoT devices are deployed in corporate environments. Beware, Internet of All Things will enable you to hook up many devices to the network, but at the present time, there is no standard for security. Amazon is asking the FCC for permission to test a new internet service. Amazon has for some time now been looking for ways to offer high-speed internet. We know Amazon is working on putting satellites into space to offer high-speed internet from space. Now, though, Amazon seems to be looking to build out a wireless network on the ground using the 3.5 gigahertz band, according to the FCC filing. This would allow Amazon to offer LTE internet service or build an internet service to be used with the Internet of Things. Amazon is asking the FCC for permission to start testing a citizens band radio service internet service in the 3.5 gigahertz band. The test would be conducted in Sunnyvale in California and it will run from August the 19th of this year through February of 19th of next year. This is on top of the permission to launch 3,236 satellites. Amazon is asking the FCC so it can start building out its new home internet service. This is something new that could supplement that service or be a standalone test. Back in early June, Jeff Bezos opened up more about his plans for high-speed internet from space sold by Amazon. The goal here is to broadband everywhere, but the very nature of having thousands of satellites in low Earth orbit is very different from geostationary satellites. You have equal broadband all over the surface of Earth. Not exactly equal, but it tends to be a lot more concentrated towards the poles. But you end up servicing the whole world, so it's really good. By definition, you end up accessing people who are under bandwidth, very rural areas, remote areas. And going forward, that internet access to broadband is going to be very close to being a fundamental human need. This is a very high expenditure undertaking. It's multi-billions of dollars. Amazon is a large enough company who can actually move the needle. This is a great news for rural American and developing countries as it could mean fast high-speed internet even if you live far from a city. Robocall blocking apps caught sending your private data without permission. Robocall blocking apps promise to rid your life of spoofed and spam phone calls. But are they trustworthy as they claim to be? One security researcher said many of these apps can violate your privacy as soon as they are open. Dan Hastings, a senior security consultant at cybersecurity firm NCC Group, analyzed some of the most popular robocall blocking apps, including TrapCaller, TrueCaller, and Hiya, and found egregious privacy violations. Robocalls are getting worse, with some getting tens or dozens of calls a day. These automated calls demand you pay the IRS a fine you don't owe or pretend to be a tech support. They often try to trick you into picking up the phone by spoofing your number to look like a local caller. But as much as the cell networks are trying to cut down on spam, many are turning to third-party apps to filter their incoming calls. But many of these apps, said Hastings, send users or device data to third-party data analytics companies, often to monetize your information without your explicit consent, instead of burying the details in their privacy policies. One app, TrapCaller, sent users' phone numbers to a third-party analytics firm, AppsFlyer, without telling users, neither in the app nor in the privacy policy. He also found TrueCaller and Hiya uploaded device data, device type, model, and software version, among other things, before a user could accept their privacy policies. Those apps, said Hastings, violates Apple's app guidelines on data use and sharing, which mandate that app makers first obtain permission before using or sending data to third parties. Many of the other apps aren't much better. Several other apps that Hastings tested immediately sent some data to Facebook as soon as the app is loaded. Without having a technical background, most end users aren't able to evaluate what data is actually being collected and sent to third parties, said Hastings. Privacy policies are the only way that a non-technical user can evaluate what data is collected about them while using an app. None of the companies acted on emails from Hastings warning about the privacy issues. It was only after he contacted Apple when TrapCaller later updated its privacy policy. But he reserved some criticism for Apple, noting that app privacy policies don't appear to be monitored, as he discovered with TrueCaller and Hiya. Privacy policies are great, but apps need to get better about abiding by them, said Hastings. If most people took the time to read and try to understand privacy policies for all the apps that they use and are able to understand them, they might be surprised to see how much these apps collect, he said. Until that day, end users will have to rely on security researchers performing manual deep dives into how apps handle their private information in practice. TrueCaller spokesperson confirmed it was sending data when the app was open, but later submitted a fix, which is now live. They said that they now comply with Apple's guidelines. Hiya conceded that it sends some device data to third-party services when opening the app, but claims it doesn't collect personal information. We are currently working on strengthening our privacy even further by resubmitting our app so that even this basic device information is not shared prior to explicit consent by the user. A spokesperson for TrapCaller did not comment when reached. As I said, who do you trust? Who has your data? Who's using it? Warning issued for Apple's 1.4 billion iPad and iPhone users. An extraordinary story of Apple neglect has resulted in a warning every iPhone and iPad user needs to know about. This was reported by Apple Insider. Security firm Checkpoint has revealed it has found a way to hack every iPhone and iPad running iOS 8 right up to the beta of iOS 13. This spread covers 8 years of devices. And with Tim Cook stating that there are 1.4 billion active iOS devices around the world, this is worrying news for the owners of pretty much of all of them. What Checkpoint discovered is that Contacts app built into iOS can be exploited using the industry standard SQLite database so that any search of contacts can trick the device into running malicious code capable of stealing user data and passwords. SQLite is the most widespread database engine in the world, said Checkpoint. It is available in every operating system, desktop and mobile phones, Windows 10, Mac OS, iOS, Chrome, Safari, Firefox, and Android are popular users of SQLite. But the real shocker is why Contact's app vulnerability existed in the first place, and it capitalizes on a known bug which Apple has failed to fix for 4 years. In short, Apple, well, they got sloppy. The bug has been considered unimportant because it was believed it could only be triggered by an unknown application accessing the database. And in a closed system like iOS, there are no unknown apps. However, Check Point's researchers then managed to make a trusted app, the ubiquitous Contacts app, send the code to trigger this bug and exploit it. Yes, it's a lazy oversight with potential serious consequences. For now, the saving grace is hackers need access to your unlocked iPhone or iPad to exploit it. But this may change. After all, just last month, 6 flaws were found in iMessage, which allowed hackers to read your files from anywhere, and one of them remains unpatched to this day. All of which puts Apple in an uncomfortable situation. The company has long touted security as a major selling point over rivals. But the holes keep coming, and when this one comes off the back of 4 years of inaction, that's not a good look at all. According to Google's own security research team, millions of shiny new Android smartphones are being purchased with dangerous malware factory installed. The danger to unsuspecting users trusting that new boxed devices are safe and clean is that some of that pre-installed malware can download other malware in the background, commit ad fraud, or even take over its host device. Android is an open source community, which is great for innovation, but not so great when threat actors seize the opportunity to hide malware in basic software loads that come on boxed devices. New phones have as many as 400 apps factory installed, many of which we just ignore. But many of those apps have not been vetted. The apps themselves will work as billed, so we may not be considering the risk. Google shared their findings at the Black Hat Convention. If malware or security issues come as pre-installed apps, then the damage it can do is greater, and that's why we need so much reviewing, auditing, and analysis. The risk impacts Android's open source project, that's AOSP, a lower cost alternative to the full fat version. AOSP is installed on lower cost smartphones where cheaper software alternatives help keep prices down. This means owners of Android badge devices from the likes of Samsung and Google itself are safe from this particular risk. For an attacker, the benefit of supply chain compromise is that they only have to convince one company to include their app, rather than thousands of users. The Google team didn't disclose any details of the brands of phones involved, but more than 200 device manufacturers fell foul of the testing, with malware allowing the devices to be attacked remotely. Of particular concern were two particular malware, Shamis, that's spelled Chamois, and Triada, Triada. Shamis generates various flavors of ad fraud, installs background apps, download plugins, and can even send premium rate text messages. Shamis alone was found to have come installed on 7.4 million devices. Triada is an older variant of malware, one that also displays ads and installs apps. Google is working to help device manufacturers screen for such vulnerabilities, and between March of last year and March of this year, such screening helped reduce the instances of devices infected by Shamis from 7.4 million to only 700,000. The Android ecosystem is vast. If you're able to infiltrate the supply chain out of the box, then you already have as many infected users as how many devices were sold. In the meantime, the usual advice applies around downloading and installing apps from the Play Store. A healthy dose of skepticism does not go amiss when the app is from an unknown source. not much users can do if those threats come from pre-installed units. And that's why this revelation is so dangerous. For this one, we need to rely on manufacturers to do the right thing and follow Google's advice in screening software fully to eradicate such risk. Other than purchasing an Android unit from Google or Samsung, what I recommend is you uninstall everything that you don't need. If you need it, then you can always go back to the Play Store to download it. After months of speculation and rumors, Huawei has officially announced its in-house operating system, which it calls Harmony OS. According to Huawei, the new microkernel-based distributed OS can be used in a wide variety of devices, including smartphones, smart speakers, wearables, and in-vehicle systems. The Chinese tech giant says this will allow the OS to create shared ecosystems across devices, with adoption encouraged through its release globally as an open source platform. In terms of release cycles, Huawei said Harmony OS is planned for launch on smart screen products later in 2019, with expansion to other devices over the next 3 years. While smart screen might be a bit ambiguous, Reuters reports that the company's subsidiary Honor is expected to release a smart TV with Harmony OS soon, potentially marking the first series of devices featuring the OS. The CEO of Huawei's consumer division says that if the company cannot use Google's Android operating system in the future, it will be able to immediately switch to Harmony OS. Even so, he still reiterated that the company would prefer to keep using Android and its smartphones. In a press release, the operating system is completely different from Android OS due to its support for a wider ecosystem. This creates ease of deployment in that developers can develop their apps once, then flexibly deploy them across a range of different devices. The reveal is certainly interesting and gives us a bit of clarity over the capabilities of Harmony OS, as it was previously indicated it was primarily designed for industrial purposes, such as for use with the Internet of Things devices. While a new ecosystem-based OS would give it an interesting position in the market, it's still a long ways to go if it wishes Harmony OS to challenge Android and get developers on side. The company is taking it one step at a time for now, though, focusing their Harmony efforts for the Chinese markets first. Unfortunately for Huawei, this week's headlines haven't been totally optimistic for them, as reports indicate that the tech giant will soon be hit with a fresh batch of bans from the United States. The bans would mean that the U.S. federal agencies will no longer be able to buy gear and services from the company as of next week. The rule will reportedly come in on an interim basis next week, while a final rule is completed. Beyond Huawei, the ban will also affect ZTE, Hytera Communications, Hangzhou Hikvision Digital Technology Company, and Dahuai Technology Company. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his continuing IT Pro Series, IT Plans.
Technology in the workplace is abundant. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now I'm going to talk to you about, yes, the relationship of work technology and your own technology at home. There's an old adage, when you fail to plan, you plan to fail. There are a lot of companies out there that don't take the time to plan out their IT strategy. And sometimes this is a matter of forward thinking. This is a matter of planning out what happens if something goes wrong. Sometimes this is forward thinking in regards to planning out how technology is going to take you from wherever you're at right now to the next step with your business. And we can apply this to our own home usage. And there are a lot of companies that really don't take the time to think about this. They don't think of computers as being an enabler. I remember, this is years ago, I remember a CEO saying, yeah, computers are just a cost center. He was a financially oriented guy. He's just sitting there and he's going, Computers just cost us money. They don't make us money. You're just a burden on us. He told that to me. I'm like, oh, that's fine. You think I'm a burden on you? Wait till I'm gone. I think he was probably surprised at that point because nobody knew what was going on with the computers and technology until they had somebody come in after me about 3 months later. And they charged them a lot of money to say, oh, yeah, you've got this problem, you got that problem, because you've been sitting around for 3 months not paying any attention to this, just ignoring this. Now, this isn't me venting. This isn't me thinking back to any of that. What I'm talking about here is everybody needs to plan on where technology is going to take them. So with a business, technology isn't a savior for business mistakes, but it can be a force multiplier. It can save you money. It can automate a number of different things. It can provide all kinds of different reporting. And that reporting can make you more profitable. It can make your employees more productive. It can eliminate the waste within the company itself. And yes, as we've stated many times before, it also can be used and leveraged to bring in more business, bring in more customers. Information technology itself isn't a business plan, though. It supports the business plan. That means you have to set in place your business plan. What is it that you want to accomplish? What is it that you want to do in the next 20 years, the next 5 years, the next year with your company? How is technology going to improve that? How is technology going to increase all of these different areas where you can improve the company? Now, you have to have an IT professional on hand to do this. You have to ask them the questions. You have to establish a lot of different things. And sometimes, yeah, you're going to make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. There are a number of things that you have to plan for. For instance, you don't buy the server that you need today. You buy the server that's going to last you the next 3 years. And you plan to replace that server in 3 years. You might say, okay, I'm going to plan to replace it. I'm going to be ready to replace it in 3 years if we get a fourth year out of it. Hey, wonderful. But you have to plan on doing that on a regular basis. And this is a business approach. Now, let's apply this to the personal approach. So you need to plan whenever you're buying a new computer, exactly what I just said. You need to plan on replacing that in 3 years. A lot of people have this idea, I'm going to buy this next laptop, and I'm going to spend a bunch of money on it, and I'm going to spend $2,000, and it's going to last me the rest of my life. Well, it'd be nice to predict how long you're going to live. I will tell you, you can't predict how long that laptop's going to last. I know somebody who did that, actually. At 45, they said, this laptop's going to last me the rest of my life. Well, let's see here. Statistical averages, you're going to live to be about 80. That laptop is going to be 35 years old. Do you think any part of that laptop is going to survive the next 35 years? No, but, you know, I want to buy the best and I want it to last forever. It's not going to last forever. You're going to give it 3 years. It's going to last 3 years. It might last 4 years. If it lasts 4 years, think of it as bonus time. But you need to replace your systems on a regular basis. We also need to plan on learning technology and learning a new technology. And that's something that we need to plan into all of our personal lives. One of those ideas that we can go through and we can just learn the bare bits, the bare amount of technology that we need to survive. No, we need to learn more. We all need to learn more. I'm saying this as an IT professional. I need to learn more technology. And those of you who don't know as much as I do, yeah, you need to learn a lot more. Because technology is coming in waves and it's going to make all of us sit here stunned in amazement at what it can do. And the last thing you want to do is be one of those people that was sitting there going, wow, it'll be great someday. I'll learn it when it gets here. It's kind of like, you know, I'll buy the new car. Wait, no, I'm not going to buy that new car because the next year has some new features. No, oh, the next year has some really cool features. Oh, the next year, it's self-driving. Yeah, you can wind up sitting there in paralysis waiting for the ultimate car to arrive. That's another whole story for another day. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The FTC is accused of misleading the public over the $125 Equifax payout. The activist group Demand Progress calls on the FTC Office of Inspector General to investigate the agency for using false and deceptive advertising regarding the money owed to consumers affected by the Equifax breach. Usually, it's the FTC that accuses others of deceptive advertising, but the U.S. regulator is now facing complaints over its handling of the Equifax settlement. An activist group, Demand Progress, announced a petition that calls on the FTC's Office of Inspector General to investigate the agency for using false and deceptive advertising regarding the money owed to consumers affected by the Equifax breach. The Federal Trade Commission led consumers to believe they get $125 if they filed a claim in the Equifax data breach settlement. But when Americans took them at their words and signed up, the FTC backtracked and claimed there wasn't enough money for the settlement fund to go around. Indeed, the FTC underestimated the public response to the Equifax settlement. So many people selected the $125 cash compensation option instead of the free credit monitoring. The $125 compensation is sourced to a fund that's been capped at $31 million. A large number of claims for cash instead of credit monitoring means only one thing. Each person who takes the money option will wind up only getting a small amount of money, nowhere near that $125 that they could have gotten if there hadn't been such an enormous number of claims filed. Why the FTC didn't allocate more than $31 million isn't clear. But Demand Progress claims the U.S. regulator misled the public about the cash compensation. The FTC should fine itself enough to ensure that all those impacted by the breach and the false advertising related to the attendant settlement receive the full $125 for which the FTC made them believe they were eligible. Demand Progress is asking the public to add their signatures to the petition, which it will send to the FTC. The commission declined to comment on the petition, but it does plan to email those who already filed their Equifax settlement claim and offer the option to switch back from the cash payment option to the free credit monitoring solution. Well, we got a problem, but let's do the math. Equifax revealed that the estimated number of affected Americans that were potentially impacted was 145.5 million. By the way, if you took the $31 million divided by 145.5 million people, that comes out to 21 cents per person. Let's say only 1% of 1% file their claims. That works out to $21 per person. I'm sure it's a lot more than 1% of 1%. What the heck was the FTC doing? When you use Google Chrome to search, you get a list of sites that have no relation to your query. When you click on one of them, you just get another useless list. Google didn't become one of the most powerful companies on the internet by providing irrelevant results to your search queries. Based on your description, it certainly sounds like your browser has been altered or hijacked by malware or adware that redirects you to sponsor links or other places where the hijackers benefit from your traffic. It's just one of those many exploits developed to generate income for the authors, who lead you to irrelevant links that pay them when you click on them. These redirect exploits can sneak in from a variety of sources, especially if you recently downloaded any new software or add-ons, which can sometimes happen without your knowledge. The most obvious sign that your browser has been exploited is your homepage is different from what it used to be, or toolbars that don't recognize that have appeared. You might also see new favorites or bookmarks just below the address bar, or if you manually look through the bookmarks. If your browsing session seems to be a lot more sluggish, this is also a potential indicator of something that has snuck in. It's possible that your default search engine might have been changed to something that redirects you to irrelevant results. To check your default search engine in Chrome, check the three vertical dots in the upper right-hand corner of the browser window and select Settings. Scroll down to the Search Engine section to see the current selection. If it doesn't say Google, you can change it by clicking on the list of options and selecting it. While you're there, click on Manage Search Engines, which will display everything that can potentially be set as your default search engine. If you see items other than Google in the top section, you can remove them from the list by clicking on the three vertical dots to the right of each entry. Check your extensions. Chrome allows you to install enhancements that add functionality and customize your browser with new features. This is also where an undesired add-on or toolbar can make its way into your browser to change how your browser works. To see what's currently installed in your browser, type the following into the address bar: Chrome:// extensions. An alphabetical list of the existing extensions will appear where you can get more details on what it does. A switch to turn it off or an option to remove it altogether. If you see anything in the list you don't recognize or don't want, click on the remove button. If you believe that the extension is malicious, you can click on the report abuse box before removing it. If after you make changes you notice that the settings get changed back, you most likely have a more sophisticated type of malware in your computer. A thorough deep scan of your computer using your antivirus security software should detect these types of infections and remove them. If that doesn't work, just completely uninstall the Chrome browser. Make sure that the subdirectory no longer have the subdirectory names related to the Chrome browser, and then download a fresh copy of the Chrome browser. I always have another browser available when I'm in a hurry. I just don't have the time to go through this procedure to find out what was done. New global workplace study finds flex time and remote working is now the new norm in the workplace. Major global study reveals 43% of U.S. employers already offer remote working, while 49% now allow employees to set own hours. Report from software company Condeco shows growth in smart tech-enabled workplaces, speed of innovation, coupled with political and economic uncertainty, identified as biggest challenge by 750 business leaders in six countries. The rise of cloud computing and teleconferencing represent both the biggest opportunity for growth as well as the most significant organizational challenge to companies around the world. Among the countries in the survey, remote working is particularly prevalent in Australia, 45%, with the U.S. tied for being the country with the second most amount of companies allowing remote work, 43%, and least widespread is Germany, 35%. However, U.S. businesses were least likely to offer flex time, 49%, while those in Singapore were most likely at 66%. In addition, 43% of U.S. businesses forecast that they will allow more remote working in the next year, while only 9% have indicated they will offer less remote working, a clear indicator that remote working is a major trend in America. 54% of U.S. companies have said they offer remote working to increase employee retention, which showcases employees' increasing demands to work from home. While recognizing digital transformation as crucial to their future success, 60% of those who participated expressed concern over the speed with which new technologies are reshaping their businesses. They are increasingly preoccupied with issues related to cloud computing, the Internet of Things, and big data. These technology challenges are contributing significantly to the changing nature of the corporate environment. Cloud computing, in particular, has made it possible for increasing number of employees to work remotely and flexibly, meaning that the central company workspace is rapidly becoming an administrative hub rather than a traditional central focus where everyone gathers during set hours. The demands for regulation and compliance are also adding to the burden felt by businesses as they face the future. Condeco's report is based on an in-depth survey of business leaders in 6 countries, including the United States, backed by qualitative interviews. Respondents overall say the biggest challenge facing their organizations in the next 12 months are digital transformation, 37%, and the adoption of new technology, 35%. Across all countries surveyed, access to the talent supply, 26%, and regulation and compliance, 24%, are considered greater organizational challenges than business uncertainty, which is 22%. Almost half of global businesses surveyed, 41%, say they already offer some degree of remote working, while 3/5, 60%, provide flex time opportunities, allowing employees to choose when to start and end their workday. The research clearly shows that businesses are in the process of transforming their workplaces digitally, which enables them to transform the way that they are used physically. Today's technology allows for space to be used more flexibly and for employees to work remotely. This benefits businesses by maximizing office space, reducing costs, and by keeping employees engaged and productive. The end of meeting room culture is when employees do go into the office. It is most often for meetings with colleagues and customers. Yet, the researchers discovered that finding, booking, and using meeting rooms is a consistent point of organizational tension, even as more people are working remotely. Fewer than a quarter of those surveyed, 23%, say that their employees have access to meeting rooms whenever they need them. However, the U.S. leads the world with 31%, compared to just 9% in Singapore. Only a third of respondents, 31%, currently use specialist meeting rooms, scheduling software to help make efficient use of the available space. Some of those surveyed believe that there was an opportunity to use artificial intelligence to book and use meeting room more effectively. AI can release individuals from routine, repetitive tasks at work and free them up for more valuable, adding and enriching activities. That's why it's likely to play an important role in meeting room booking software. Businesses are only beginning to realize the extent to which the need for co-workers to meet in person is a thing of the past, and as new conferencing systems enable teams to maintain real-time collaboration and conversation across vast distances and multiple time zones. Ultimately, new technology will enable businesses to allocate their resources and time more effectively. There's also a role it can play in gathering data, but companies need to be aware of the ethical and privacy aspects of using it in this way and be prepared to be fully transparent in communicating what they are doing to their employees. While 1/5 of business leaders worldwide, 22%, said that uncertainty was a concern for them, less than 1/5 of American business leaders, 16%, echoed this. The most common concern for U.S. respondents is technology adoption, 45%, and the talent supply, 30%, suggesting that businesses are expecting these to be major issues over the next year. Only 11% of U.S. businesses cited access to capital as their top organizational concern. Acoustic wallboard interior walls may seem hard and inflexible, but when it comes to noise, they can pass through like a second side of a big bass drum. Can you get things to be less noisy by taking a wall and sticking a sock in it? Hey, Marty, give us some of your wisdom on how we can all listen as he beats his head against the wall.
A lot of people who live in apartments are convinced the walls must be made out of paper because they can hear everything going on next door. As it happens, that's the normal nature of walls, even in single-family houses. But in those houses, there's less likely to be people doing everything right on the other side of the wall. And in houses, exterior walls are likely to have some kind of thermal insulation inside, which helps. But let's look at what really happens. For starters, consider a drumhead, especially on a big bass drum or a big kettle drum. The thumping on a bass drum starts with a whack on the drumhead on the drummer's side and comes out the drumhead on the audience side. That works because there's air inside. Whacking the one side means a big push to the air on the inside of the drum, and that air pushes the head on the other side just about exactly as much. The bass drum is a cylinder, so the air is contained by it, and the thump comes through with both strength and direction. A kettle drum uses its shape to echo the sound of the thump back out the drum head, and with that tiny bit of delay, well, it gets a different kind of presence, a little bit of self-contained echo. In both cases, the main part that's moving is the drum head. Loudspeakers work like that too, only instead of getting thumped, they get activated by something that moves like a sound wave that's in the middle of something that moves like a drum head. In bigger hi-fi speakers, that something is a paper cone. In an earbud, it may be foil or plastic. Skinny, flat surfaces that move to make sound, or in the case of a microphone, that sound moves to make a signal, those and drum heads are all identifiable as diaphragms. Remember, it's air that carries sound, and thin, flat things are easy for air to make move. And skinny, flat things that move can move a lot of air. Relatively speaking, walls are skinny, flat things. Maybe not as skinny as paper, but skinny enough that sound hitting on one side will tend to push the other side just as much. They're not built to block sound, they're built to pass it on. It's like taking a tin can telephone, pulling the string off, and making the cans touch. Skip the string in the middle, and that sound still gets through loud and clear. Not that wallboard is as good as drum heads at passing a lot of sound through. Sorry, I called it wallboard. That hard surface at the walls of your room has many names. Wallboard, plasterboard, drywall, sheetrock, or gypsum board, among others. I'll just call it wallboard, so if you're more familiar with one of those other terms, please just indulge me. One claim of standard wallboard, is that it somewhat reduces the loudness of sounds that come through the wall. Somewhat. I've heard recommendations that using extra thick wallboard or multiple layers of wallboard will reduce the sound level even more. Well, that makes sense. The thicker the walls, the heavier and the more massive. And if the sound must move more mass, it's going to be less effective at doing that. It only has so much energy, and it won't be able to move your side of the wall quite as much. And your side of the wall moving less, meaning, no, that means that what you hear won't be as loud. But there's a new trick out there now. It's a divide and conquer and stop for a nap kind of treatment that's happening in similar but different in the details ways from several wallboard manufacturers. It's wallboard that's purpose-built for acoustic sound reduction. It's interesting and kind of clever. Here's the basic approach. These sound-stopping wallboards are really a permanently bonded-together sandwich of two thinner sheets, normal wallboard thinner sheets, separated by a spongy foam center layer between them. It's a little like putting pillows between your earbuds and your ears. The sound vibrations from the other room may move that side's wall a little, but the foam is acting as a shock absorber to absorb a lot of that energy. And guess what? The wall on your side barely moves at all. Overall, these wallboards alone cut the sound level in half. Want to kick that up a notch? There are more tricks you can try. You could put these sound-cutting wallboards on both sides of the wall, but that might not be needed if you have other ways of muffling the sound. What's between the wood studs inside the wall? The framing, what's in there? Fiberglass roll insulation will help a little, but you're a lot better off filling the gap with open-cell polyurethane foam. It's an acoustic reduction foam. And you can also use a thin strip of rubber between the back of the wallboard and the framing studs when you nail the board on to help reduce the amount that the studs can transfer sound. By the way, through the wall isn't the only way that sound from the next room might be reaching you. There are other routes it can take. A more complete solution should also involve attention to ceilings, to floors, to doors, and especially to ventilation ducts. Or try this. You can buy a house in another state and make it a gift to that noisy neighbor. Would that work? Well, sure, it's expensive. But there's always a high price on hush money. Next time, and speaking of time, those LED bulbs we've all been buying say they're good for a long time. They talk about decades. But that can involve some misleading math. And besides that, there may be lots of reasons for a much earlier demise. I'll help you understand what's happening when LEDs die young. But unlike some of those bad bulbs, I won't leave you in the dark.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open, free to the public. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on the future of Windows, Thursday, August the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. The Princeton PC Users Group meet Tuesday, August the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society meets Tuesday, September the 3rd. They meet at 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hackerspace, located at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group meet Thursday, September the 5th. Their meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 6th. They meet at 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Computer Learning Center at Ewing meets Tuesday, September the 10th, and they meet at 2 p.m. at the Ewing Senior and Community Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road at Ewing, New Jersey. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, September the 10th, and their meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, September the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU in the Silver Building, room 414, located at 32 Waverly Place, and that's in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meet Friday, September 13th. Their meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, out in Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have any computer club meetings you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet as well as pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.